The Christians in Galatia, which is part of modern-day Turkey, were mostly former Celtic pagans. Now, I've referenced this in the previous two messages in this series on the Galatian dilemma, because their background, where they came from, the environment that Paul went into, is critically important to understand, both for what Paul teaches next and also to help us to understand how the early Christian church developed from the teachings of Jesus to what we more traditionally think of as Christian doctrine. Prior to hearing the Apostle Paul preach his gospel, because they were, at that time, pagan Celts, they would likely have heard nothing about Jesus and would have known little to nothing about Jewish law and practices. They certainly would not have been looking for a Messiah in the Hebrew or a Christ in the Greek language, because these titles referred specifically to a king, in this case, an anticipated king of Israel. So a gospel that included circumcision, Sabbath keeping, and refraining from eating pork and shellfish would have had little appeal to Celtic pagans. The call to become a covenant people with the God of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, would have held no interest for pagans. The message of the exodus out of Egypt, the captivities in Assyria and Babylon, were Israel stories, and Celts had their own legends and history. But Celts, like everyone else, worried about what would happen when they died. And Paul had an answer and focused his teaching answering that question, because he claimed to have met someone, albeit in a trance, who had died and then lived again, a unique man who was now in a spirit form, exalted, lifted up to the right hand of God, to make life after this life possible for everyone, Jew or Gentile. And that message is what connected to thousands. The great God above all pagan gods actually loved people, said Paul. But that God was a God of justice, and rebellion against him needed to be punished in order for life to go on after this one. And all, said Paul, all had rebelled to one degree or another. And the solution, said Paul, was that the one who had died, this man that he had met in his vision, Jesus the Anointed, had been sinless in his human life and bore our sin in his body on the cross. So all that Jews or Celts or Asians or Arabic people had to do was accept all they had to do. Nothing more was accept that sacrifice on their behalf, and they too would be free from what Paul referred to as the final enemy, death. In the meantime, the only law that still applied to followers of this Jesus the Anointed, the only law they needed to adhere to, was the law which stated that you should love your neighbor as yourself. And in Galatians 5, Paul offers an overview of what that neighbor love would look like. So today I'd like to zero in on the first two of four categories that I've divided the works of the flesh into that Paul identified. And the four categories are spiritual perversion, unrestrained emotions, lack of moral self-control, and community disharmony. So we'll look at the first two today. Paul presents these as illustrations of what spiritless human brokenness and dysfunction look like. And as I've mentioned before, this is not everything that you could call a work of the flesh, but this is an outline of the kinds of things that we should root out in our life. So the first category is spiritual perversion. And he lists, first of all, idolatry. Now, what do you think of when you hear the word idolatry? The most obvious image is that of a person or a group of people in an ancient temple praying to, perhaps sacrificing to, burning incense to, or bringing gifts to pay homage to a manufactured statue of a deity. In the Christian context, it is often said that idolatry is anything that you put in your life ahead of God. This is not what Paul is specifically talking about. Paul is talking about a very specific, sophisticated spiritual concept. Now, before I explain what that is, I want to clarify something that I never really thought about or didn't know until a few years ago, and that is that pagans did not think that idols were gods. They viewed them as a means through which one could reach the gods. And that's a very important distinction, because it kind of makes pagans sound a bit dumb. They make this little carving and they call it, give it a name, and they think it's a god. That's ridiculous. Well, they would have thought that was just as ridiculous as you might. The author of Deuteronomy tells the Israelites, it's a warning to them, that if they disobey Yahweh, that God will scatter them among the people, and only a few of them would survive. And then he says, and in those nations where I will scatter you as a punishment for not following me, I will make you to serve man-made gods of wood and stone, which cannot see or hear or eat or smell. That's Deuteronomy 4:28. This is either a sarcastic jab at the heathen nations, or the author was just unfamiliar with these pagan religious practices. Heathens knew perfectly well that their idols had no life within them. And of course, the stone or wood carving made by their hands, of course, could not hear anything, could not answer back, could not talk. No pagan ever claimed that their idols spoke to them and gave them a message. Nor did they think that their idols could move around the room or perform acts or heal or do anything that one might think a god could do. They were simply an object through which to reach the gods. No different than the way that some Christians will have a statue in their room of an apostle or a saint or Mary and pray to that painting or that statue. They don't think that that is Mary or that that is Saint Ignatius. They're just, it's an aid for them in their prayer. What Paul is referring to in Galatians 5 as idolatry is the formal sacrificial feasts held in honor of those gods. The word in Greek means literally the vice that springs from idolatry. He wasn't talking about using a carved symbol of your god. That wasn't the issue. It was what was happening at those feasts while they were worshiping their gods. It was the vice. The works of the flesh in this case were the overindulgence during the celebrations. Celebrations which sometimes included excessive and deviant immoral behavior. And it was a work of the flesh because ultimately it demonstrated, and this is a key characteristic in all the works of the flesh, these are things that demonstrate no love towards others only love to self, self-indulgence, self-obsession. And Paul saw these practices taking place while they were worshiping their idols, and that's specifically what he targeted. The second spiritual perversion that Paul lists is witchcraft. Now, the Greek word for witchcraft here is pharmakeia. Pharmakeia. What does that sound like? The word literally would be translated as drugging, as in pharmacies. It's a reference to the use of plant-based hallucinogenic drugs, poisons, aphrodisiacs, etc., that were used in sorcery or magical arts. The word witchcraft had nothing to do with black cats, cauldrons, or old hags flying on brooms through the air at night. That was an invention of the Middle Ages. When Paul wrote to the Galatians, both men and women were involved in pharmakeia. In fact, the study of magic in the Greco-Roman world was considered to be a serious classical discipline, like astronomy, medicine, rhetoric, poetry. It was believed by many ancient, perhaps most ancient people, that disease always had a supernatural cause. And so priests and shamans needed to provide a response when someone was sick based on incantations, a kind of repetitive word prayer, trying to speak to the gods, along with the use of the healing properties, as they believed, supernatural healing properties of plants and objects. Of course, we now know that disease does not have a supernatural origin. It has a bacterial or a viral or some other kind of natural cause, and that plant-based or synthetic drugs may, without any sense of magic or sorcery, be used to help and aid in healing when used correctly with our body's natural chemistry. But if you didn't know that, if you didn't know the science, if you didn't know the chemistry and the biology of disease, you would assume, easily assume, that there was some evil at play in your life when you had, for example, a tumor, or you had a gangrene or malaria. You would want to have a supernatural response to evil in your body. And so, without the knowledge of the Christian God, the pagans appealed to their gods in the same way that we might pray for healing. For Paul, witchcraft was a work of the flesh because witchcraft and magic were competing against the belief that it was only the Christian God who should be sought for healing and any kind of intervention in this life. Although Paul himself was convinced that others, such as, for example, Simon the sorcerer, were certainly able to have the power to bring supernatural effects of the divine world into this one. The second category of works of the flesh is unrestrained emotions. And the first unrestrained emotion that Paul deals with is jealousy. In the Greek, the word is zelo, the same root as the word zealous, very fervent kind of emotion. Now, the definition of zelo tells us almost everything we need to know about what jealousy is 2,000 years ago, what it was, and what it is now. The definition is fearful or wary of losing affection or position to others, or overguarding what you have for fear of losing it. Fearful or wary of losing affection or position to others, or overguarding what you have for fear of losing it. This work of the flesh is particularly interesting to me today because in our society, We are far more overall affluent than ever before. We have more conveniences than ever. And we are more pampered and comfortable than ever before. And yet we are just as obsessed with protecting our abundance as people were many, many years ago when they had comparatively very little. And in a strange twist, it seems like some people today who don't have as much as others, but some people feel that they deserve not just to have what others have, but for those who are more affluent to not have what they have. Some people feel like they deserve for you not to have what you have if you have nice things. A secondary school in Merseyside, which is northwest England, traditionally a very, very poor working class industrial part of Britain. This school in Merseyside has banned pupils from wearing expensive designer coats in an attempt to stop what they're labeling as poverty shaming. After the Christmas break this year, students at the Wood Church High School in Birkenhead will not be allowed to wear brands including Canada Goose, Montclair, and Pyrenex. "We're very concerned," said head teacher Rebecca Phillips, "about the fact that our children are putting a lot of pressure on parents to buy them expensive coats." Well, what happened to the word no? Those pupils who did not have expensive outerwear were upset, she continued. "They feel stigmatized. They feel left out. They feel inadequate," she said. So by this reasoning, if you have a $1,000 coat, which is about what a Canada Goose parka is, if you have a $1,000 coat or an $80,000 luxury vehicle, and I don't, you are making me feel inadequate by wearing that coat or driving around showing off in your BMW. That's nonsense. Unless you are actually ridiculing my lack of a $1,000 coat, or unless you are mocking my hail-damaged Subaru, you are not doing anything to me by what you wear and drive. The problem is, if I have affluence and you don't, and if you wish that you did have what I have, and if you don't want me to have what I have because you don't and can't have it, if you can follow that, then I am not the problem. Me having the $1,000 coat or the $80,000 vehicle is not the problem. The problem is a work of the flesh called jealousy. And we need to label it what it is. Donald Trump recently named a friend of his, Lana Marks, to be the U.S. ambassador to South Africa. Lana Marks designs luxury handbags. Anyone ever heard of Lana Marks? Designs luxury handbags which can retail, and guys, you will not believe this. Ladies, you might. Guys, handbags for $400,000. I know what you're thinking. I could get 2 Corvettes for that price. 2 ZR1s. 2 of those or a handbag. I mean, the Corvettes have 700 horsepower, gentlemen. Or a handbag. And unless you're making fun of my 20-year-old $50 Staples briefcase, then I shouldn't care how much your handbag cost. In fact, the Apostle Paul tells us in Romans 12:15 to rejoice with those who rejoice. Obviously, consumer possessions are not the context of his statement there. But in general, I should be happy if you are happy because you have something very nice, even if I don't. But the other side of jealousy is the failure to care about the needs of others because you're so busy overprotecting, not protecting, overprotecting what you have. Jesus presented a very important parable about exactly this jealously guarding and hoarding, afraid to let go and give and be generous. He says in Luke 12, verse 13 to 21, someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, you know exactly what's going on here. A parent had a favorite. A parent dies, or parents. The will is read. One brother gets everything. The other brother gets nothing. The one who gets nothing says, "That's not fair. Mom and Dad always liked you better. You should split that with me." And the other brother says, "No, it's the will. It was the will of my parents. I should get it all. They never liked you. I don't like you. And legally, I'm entitled to all of it." And legally, they are entitled to all of it. That's what a will is for. But this individual is clearly jealously guarding what is not his, but wants it and will do whatever it takes. So he appeals to Jesus, who was viewed as a wise rabbi, and says, "Can you help me out here? Make my brother give me what I think belongs to me, but legally doesn't." And Jesus just says, "Well, I'm not your judge. Who appointed me to be the judge between you and your brother? You guys sort it out yourself." And it seems like there's a pause in the conversation, and Jesus may have even been walking away thinking, "This is nothing to do with me. Don't ask me to get involved in this." But then he comes back and he says, "Wait a minute. I just want to warn you. Be careful. I see something in your attitude that is poison to you." He says, "Watch out. Be on guard against all kinds of greed." And then he utters these infamous, true for all times words. "Life does not consist of the abundance of your possessions." He's saying there's something far greater than who gets the will. Is it worth destroying the life you have to have more, to have something you didn't have a week ago? You've never had it. It's never belonged to you. And he told them this parable. "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an amazingly abundant harvest. And this man thought to himself, 'I have far more than I could possibly eat. I have everything I want. What will I do with all this excess? I don't even have room to store my crops.' Now, one option would be you could give it away to the hungry. You could sell it at a very low price to make sure that people in want have something at a good cost." And then he said, "This is what I'll do. The problem isn't that I have too much. The problem is I don't have enough storage. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, 'You now have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry. This is all for you.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you.'" In other words, you're going to die. "And then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God." Let me clarify. That last phrase does not mean those who are not rich towards the church. How are we to be rich towards God? Because God doesn't need your money. You can't mail a check to heaven. I mean, you could try. How do you give to God? You are usually taught in churches that you do that by giving to the church. And that is a perversion of the law of love. According to the Apostle Paul, as we pointed out in the first of this series, you love God, how? By loving your neighbor. We are rich towards God, especially by being rich towards our neighbors in need. That is exactly who this man, this rich man with so much that he couldn't even contain everything he had, that was what he was supposed to do with his wealth. Not jealously guard it and hoard it. Not give away everything that he had to the poor. He was expected to look after himself and to make sure that he had enough and a little bit extra perhaps. But he couldn't give grain to God. What is the only other response he could have done with that? Give it to those in need. At its core, jealousy comes from a state, for some people, a continual and perpetual state of dissatisfaction with wherever they are in life and with whatever they have in life. It's never satisfied. And the marketing world absolutely knows that and plays on that. You can't walk into a Costco or an electronics store without recognizing how old your television is and how low definition it is compared to these amazing, sharp, bright new ones. It's almost identical to the TV you had 10 years ago, but it's a little bit sharper. And for another $2,000, you could have one too. And instead of using that $2,000 in some more constructive way, some people have to get the new everything all the time. And look, we live in a world where we function with electronics. I'm not knocking having things that are nice or renewing something that is worn and old and having what you want. I think you understand that. This is talking about a perpetual state of dissatisfaction that feeds you, drives you to get things you don't need, that never ends. In other words, even if you manage to have what you were jealous of or wanting continually out of a state of dissatisfaction, even if you got that, you wouldn't satiate that feeling, that core underlying feeling of dissatisfaction. And like all the works of the flesh, jealousy is corrosive, addictive, irrational, it makes no sense, unproductive, and destructive. And the antidote, says Paul, is to be content with and lavishly generous with whatever you have. And to replace the spirit of dissatisfaction with the spirit of openness, generosity, and a release from being so connected to stuff. The next work of the flesh in the emotional category is hatred and fits of rage. There are times for all of us when we encounter people whom we just dislike. I know I've encountered people who dislike me before they even know all the reasons to dislike me. We encounter people we mistrust. We don't even really know why. We just get a feeling. I don't trust this person. There are people whose personalities clash with ours, and we find them irritating to be around. There are people that we have good reason to be angry with. There are even times when our anger turns to hatred towards other people. And I would say that as long as even hatred and anger subsides relatively quickly, ideally because we've resolved the conflict and the issues, we're still in a spiritually healthy place. I believe that the kind of hatred that Paul was talking about is what I would call chronic hatred. Some people hate other people they've never even met. How do you do that? How do you hate a whole race of people? Some men hate almost all women. Some women hate all men. What Paul is describing is a condition that some translations even translate as enmity. Everyone's an enemy, or lots of people are your enemy, or you're quick to make people your enemy. It's a state where we harbor and nurture hatred. You won't let it go. It's part of your identity. It may be based on a small amount of rational objectivity, someone once did something that was hurtful to you, and so everyone else like that is part of that same problem. But the rest is just a feeling you get, and you don't care to know why it's there, but you're sure it's justified. Paul is saying that this unrestrained hatred is a work of the flesh, and that person needs to allow the Spirit of God to produce fruit of peace, personal inner peace first, and peace towards others. The final work of the flesh that we'll look at today is selfish ambition. Selfish ambition. You know, ambition plays a central role in the American dream. It is assumed that there is inherent value in the concept of striving to have more and more and more, and to be more, and to rise in wealth and status in some kind of rapid trajectory. But like jealousy, the wrong kind of ambition is feeding off a perpetual dissatisfaction with where you are in life today. And it is corrosive, and it is consuming. Why? Why do we always need to have more? In Ecclesiastes 5:10-12, it's interesting, this is probably written about 2,500 to 3,000 years ago, and nothing's changed. Whoever loves money never has enough. It's clearly the love of money. It's not the money. It's not wrong to want more. It's not wrong to have a wage that doesn't cover your basic necessities of life and want to have enough so that you're comfortable. But whoever loves that money never has enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with their income. He says, this is meaningless. This, we believe, was written by someone in their later years, looking back over their life, someone who probably did have a love of money, an obsession with wealth, an obsession with gathering and hoarding, and looking back and thinking, well, what was the good of this? What good does this do me now? As goods increase, or things that you purchase, and things that you clearly are beyond anything you need, then so do those who come around to consume them. And what benefit are they to the owners except to feast their eyes on them? The sleep of a laborer is sweet. Someone who's satisfied that if they put in a good day's work, they get a reward for that. Even if it's not much, it's honest. And whether they eat little or much, their labor is sweet. Even if they eat little. But as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep. Ecclesiastes goes on here to say that our ambition should be, yes, be ambitious, but have ambition for a quality of life, not a quantity of wealth. And if wealth comes along too, enjoy it. But the ambition should be for a quality of life. And how do you gain a quality of life? First and foremost, by loving God, by loving your neighbor, particularly those neighbors in need. The spirit of selfish ambition, like all the other works of the flesh, is corrosive, addictive. Remember that. It is addictive. You can get stuck in this and find hard to get out of it. And it is insatiable. It's never fed. It's never enough. But this can be replaced with the fruit of the spirit of joy and inner quiet, inner peace.